KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
It's time for the Fish Report here on KSDP. We have harvest numbers for the Alaska Peninsula, as well as some more escapement updates for the AK pen as well. The harvest summaries for Kodiak right now are confidential, but yesterday there was a report of 31,000 sockeye delivered across the Alaska Peninsula, 6,000 pinks and 6,000 chum as well added to that total. For the Shumagin Islands, there's now a total of 973 fish delivered across the Shumagin Islands as of the 11th of June, 2025. First deliveries for the South Unimak reported, 31,000 sockeyes delivered in the South Unimak area, 6,300 pink salmon, and 6,200 chum salmon reported for the Unimak area. Looking at the AK Peninsula Weir report, Chignik River had 2,600 fish up the weir yesterday. They're now at 20,500 to date. Again, that's the best since 2017. Nelson River had 1,170 fish up the weir yesterday. They're at 1,470, and that is one of their best escapements. In fact, the best escapement since 2016. 380 fish up the Bear River, putting them on the lower middle end. The Illinik has 197 up yesterday for a total of 2,500, also putting them on the middle lower end. Wierzynski Weir was installed yesterday, but there are no fish reported yet, and the Iliuk River had 3 fish for a total of 4 to date. That will do it for the fish report here on KSDP.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native American tribes are advising members to carry paper documentation as they travel to avoid being caught up in ICE raids of immigrants. Since President Trump's push to arrest and deport undocumented immigrants began with his second term, reports of Native people being confronted about their citizenship status by ICE agents have been happening all across Indian country. This week, the Torres Martinez Desert Kaweah Indians of Southern California issued notice to their members to carry a state-issued driver's license, a certificate of degree of Indian blood, and a tribal ID card as their primary documents. Passports, social security cards, military IDs, and birth certificates are also recommended. The tribe says all Native Americans are U.S. citizens and therefore not subject to being deported, but having documentation can avoid wrongful detention and harassment. A controversial measure in the province of Ontario was recently passed into law. It gives the cabinet of the government of Premier Doug Ford the power to create special economic zones where certain resource projects could be exempt from provincial laws. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the bill passed, even though there was widespread opposition from lawmakers, environmentalists, and Indigenous groups.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford says Bill 5 was urgently needed in the face of the trade war started by U.S. President Donald Trump. It's also called the Protect Ontario by Unleashing Our Economy Act. It would speed up the process for allowing major infrastructure and resource projects, such as critical mineral extraction, and make Ontario one of the world's fastest regimes to approve permits. Even though there was widespread opposition, Ford's government has a majority in the Ontario legislature, and the law was passed quickly. Among those to speak against the new law was Linda Damasigi, a Grand Chief of the Anishinaabeg First Nation.
We are disappointed and very concerned that Ontario has proceeded in a way it has without any meaningful consultation, engagement, and accommodation to our First Nations. Bill 5 can be viewed as circumventing protections that are seen as impediments or obstacles to development and furthering the colonial regimes of old and a continued disregard for the treaty relationship. I caution you not to sell out our First Nation rights, heritage, and history in your frenzied attempt to appease the U.S. President, unleash our natural resources, and establish a foothold in the global economy.
Ontario's Minister of Indigenous Affairs says there will be consultations with Indigenous groups after Bill 5 has passed. That hasn't happened yet. Other Native leaders say those talks should have taken place before the legislation was developed, not after. The question now is how soon the Ford government will act to designate any location in the province a special economic zone. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Last week, the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community hosted the Arizona Diamondbacks annual baseball softball competition for Native American youth. The summertime tradition, known as the D-backs Intertribal Tournament, is now in its 25th year. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has this report.
Rising tribal players from near and far shine while competing in the intertribal tourney under the bright lights at Talking Stick Resort's Salt River Fields. This year has grown to 75 teams, about 1,100 indigenous youth, representing more than 20 tribes from all over Arizona, California, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. 4 days, 3 divisions, 103 games in all. Oklahoma's Tribe of Gad Warriors won 4-2 over AZ Heat in the Thursday night AAA Finals, scoring its second consecutive championship. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from Salt River Fields.
And I'm Brian Bull for National Native News.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Haven't felt like it has had a meaningful role. And I think that's one of the things that we're looking for.
Anchorage revives a public safety commission for residents to give feedback to law enforcement. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, North Slope Borough residents attempting to recall their mayor say delayed response from officials hampered their efforts.
4 main complaints for Josiah. And they still stand, but she watered them down.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The U.S. House today passed President Trump's rescission request, taking back $9.4 billion from foreign aid programs and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The legislation would put into law some of the spending cuts the Trump administration already made, and it would eliminate the next 2 years of federal funding for public media outlets. Alaska Congressman Nick Begich, like most Republicans, voted for the bill. His office did not respond to an interview request this afternoon. In a statement, he said the rescission bill targets programs that, quote, do not reflect the will of the taxpaying public, end quote. The bill goes next to the Senate. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan have not said how they will vote on it. After being dormant for years, Anchorage city leaders are working to relaunch a public safety advisory commission that would give community members the opportunity to weigh in on how the police and other public safety agencies operate in the city. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, organizers say they want the commission to foster cooperation and reduce division amid a tense time for the police department.
For several years, Rich Kirtner was one of the people in Anchorage pushing for the police department to have body cameras. He's a retired attorney who works with the Alaska Black Caucus and the Alaska Coalition for Justice. As the body camera process was ongoing, he says he went to the Assembly's Public Safety Committee meetings to see what other conversations community members were having around police accountability.
I didn't get anything out of it. It wasn't very active. And so I didn't I went a couple meetings and then I just quit going to there.
Anchorage used to have a more active Public Safety Advisory Commission designed to give citizens an opportunity to weigh in on how the police and other public safety departments in the city operate. Assemblymember Cameron Perez-Verdia says the commission has been defunct for years, prompting the assembly to work to reimagine what a commission like that could look like now.
The commission hasn't felt like it has had a meaningful role. And I think that's one of the things that we're looking for. So that people who serve on it and then the public who looks to this commission knows that this role is meaningful and it is actually has a stake in what's going on.
The move comes amid a tenuous time for the police department. Officers started wearing body cameras at the end of 2023. Since then, the city has seen a slew of police shootings, with officers shooting 13 people since last May. 8 people died as a result, including a 16-year-old girl, prompting widespread outrage and a call for a review of the police department's policies. Earlier this year, Kirtner and Assemblymember Felix Rivera were named co-conveners of a task force aimed at restarting Anchorage's Public Safety Advisory Commission. Rivera says the goal is to foster a better relationship between the community and the police.
It's really supposed to explore how does the public interact with public safety from a variety of perspectives, from sort of a data transparency perspective, but also, and you know, sometimes people are afraid to say this word because it causes all kinds of different reactions, but also from an oversight perspective.
Rivera says he understands that a call for oversight of the police department could be seen as a criticism of the police. But he says at their core, officers are public servants, and he wants the relationship between the public and the police to be closer.
I think we can look at it as a way to really increase trust, build relationships. And that's what I'm hoping here in this process, that it does all of those things. What I don't want to have happen in this process is a divisive process where folks are sort of pointing the finger at each other.
Kirtner says another goal of the advisory commission is to increase transparency. He says he felt like the process to get body cameras on officers wasn't very transparent, and he thinks the public deserves to know how the police are operating.
I don't think that's a negative for anybody. Just, you know, open transparency about what's going on, good and bad, would be good for the community. And that's where the community, I think, is really up in arms, is not knowing what's going on, not with a lack of transparency.
Mayor Suzanne LaFrance expressed support for the revamping of the advisory commission at a press conference about public safety last month.
I think it's really important for the administration and the assembly to have access to the expertise and feedback and perspectives of citizens, and because we want to have full representation in our community.
Police Chief Sean Case has been hesitant to explicitly support the creation of a form of civilian oversight of the police, in the past expressing concern for how it would impact morale for the department as it works to recruit and retain its officers. At the same press conference, he said he felt it was a bit premature to weigh in.
As we go through the process, not just what we want to get out of the commission moving forward or what we did not get out of the commission previously, it's what kind of do we have legal access to? Do we want to look at policies and training and, you know, complaints that come and go, and not just with the police department, with some of our other public safety entities.
Rivera says he and Kirtner aim to bring a list of recommendations for the creation of the commission to the full assembly in October.
October is generally in the middle of budget season, and so it gives the assembly a prime opportunity, if there are budgetary recommendations, for us to consider those.
He says the plan is for the task force to have its first meeting in late June or early July. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Petitioners working to remove the North Slope borough mayor from office failed to gather enough signatures to hold a recall vote, according to the borough clerk. The Alaska Desk's Aliona Nyden reports.
A group of residents have been working to recall Mayor Josiah Alaksarak Patkatak since winter. They say Patkatak received compensation for luxurious travel with his family before the local assembly voted to allow the practice. Borough Clerk Sheila Burke issued a recall petition for Patkatak in March, and authors had until the end of May to gather signatures. They collected less than a half of the required number. Former Inupiaq language teacher Beverly Akak Hugo is one of the petition's authors. She says the recall efforts were hampered by the slow response from the borough and changes to the petition by Burke.
this group got turned off when that first petition that she made without all of our complaints, four main complaints for Josiah, and they still stand, but she watered them down.
Burke had said she adjusted the petition to only include recallable matters. The final document included the mayor's use of public funds for his family travel. However, it omitted other arguments from petitioners, like using the borough's medevac plane for non-medical errands, approving too many nepotism waivers, and misusing public funds to open an office in Anchorage. The group also filed a court complaint back in March, after the borough didn't respond to their recall application for several weeks. That case is ongoing in the Utqarevik court. A separate petition was also issued to recall Assembly President Crawford Patkatak, who is the mayor's father. Petitioners said that when Crawford Patkatak voted to allow compensation for officials' family travel, he did not disclose his personal interest in protecting his son. The clerk said the recall petition for him missed the filing deadline, which was 180 days before the end of his term this fall. Petitioners argue the deadline was missed because of the slow response from the borough. The mayor's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In Anchorage, I am Alena Naiden.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, woman-owned tattoo shops gained popularity in Anchorage by creating a welcoming environment.
We're fortunate that a lot of studios here are pretty inclusive and safe places for all people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play, clean, go. Removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance wants to create two overnight car camping spots for homeless people this summer. Farina Brown with the mayor's office says the idea is to increase outreach to those living in their vehicles. She says it would also increase safety for residents of Anchorage.
We at the municipality receive a lot of complaints and concerns about those vehicles. Individuals that are actually camping in those spaces don't have access to hygiene facilities such as restroom and sanitation, so it can often be perceived as a lot of coming and going.
Brown says the city has not selected the two locations for permitted car camping. There is a long list of potential spots, and Brown says the final decision depends on who the city hires to manage the project. She says the plan is to avoid residential areas, schools, playgrounds, and shelters, and she says people will have a chance to weigh in once the sites are selected.
There will be robust conversation about any location identified for designated parking.
Brown says they're hoping that each site would have space for 25 vehicles. All vehicles would have to be registered and running, and drivers would have to be licensed. And all campers would be required to register and agree to follow program rules, including no drugs, alcohol, or unauthorized visitors. There would be bathrooms and garbage cans, as well as two staff monitors per site. The area would be open from 6 p.m. until 8 a.m. Brown says staff monitors would contact the Anchorage Police Department for backup as needed.
I don't anticipate that we're going to see 25 vehicles that are all violating the rules. You might have one or two individuals that are, and they would be removed from the site.
The mayor's office says the goal is to open two parking areas by mid to late July. Many coastal Alaskans say that a half century of the state's limited entry system for commercial fishing has resulted in an economic crisis for residents of small, often predominantly Native communities. That's according to the Northern Journal, which also found most state lawmakers disinterested in the topic of changing how Alaska's commercial fishing permitting works. Northern Journal reporter Nat Herz says at the heart of it are advocates who want more opportunities for rural, young Alaskans to fish for a living.
if you're an 18-year-old and you're growing up in a Bristol Bay village, where do you get $250,000 for a permit plus another couple hundred thousand dollars for a boat and nets and everything else? Like, it's not really feasible. And a lot of folks say this system really isn't working. It's causing our coastal rural Gulf of Alaska economies to kind of shrivel up and die. Can we do something about it?
So they described it as a crisis. What did lawmakers in Juneau tell you when you asked them about this crisis?
I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. This is an issue, as one lawmaker who I spoke to about it described it, this is an issue that's been cooking for 50 years, right? So it's like it's a system failure, and it's a system failure that's been sort of slowly playing out over 50 years. And I think, like, if you're attuned to it, if you live in a village, you have ties to a village, you've been campaigning in a village, you'd be acutely aware of it. But most of the lawmakers in Juneau, A, don't represent coastal rural Alaska. They represent, like, urban Alaska, the Mat-Su, Anchorage, Fairbanks. They don't really have any idea that this is happening because, again, it's like a small population of Alaska, a small number of people who don't have, like, a large lobbying presence in Juneau. And then the folks also who represent more rural Alaska areas, they also have this sort of countervailing constituency of folks who maybe bought permits or own permits and don't necessarily want to see the system kind of tinkered with even around the edges, because, as I think a lot of your listeners know, like, the fishing industry has been in real chaos over the past few years. Like, people don't want anything to happen that's going to make even sort of a marginal negative impact on the number of fish they're allowed to catch or the value of their permit or something like that.
I mean, is that to say that they're concerned that potentially adding more permits would dilute the value of the ones that they have?
Yeah, I think one of the issues here is that there isn't a consensus about sort of what exactly do you do to fix this systemic failure. Like, do you create a new class of permits that's only accessible for people who live in these small coastal rural villages? Do you allow tribes to own permits and sort of manage them communally and fish them communally, which is something that isn't currently allowed because there's sort of a fear of consolidation and non-individual ownership? I think right now, there's much more of just this big question of, oh, we need to fix the system. And I think people who are in the system here fix the system and they think, okay, this is code for taking it out of us. And I think, you know, certainly you change the system and it's going to impact existing players. But, like, you know, there's a lot of analysis and work and conceptualization that has to go into that that hasn't really happened because lawmakers haven't been working on it intensively yet. And I think, you know, the one thing that they've made really clear, I went to a reception in Juneau where the Sea Alaska interim president, Joe Nelson, who's also the co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, he spoke. And the thing that he said is, like, we don't have a specific ask for you yet. But one thing he said was, we're not trying to, like, take it out of the highliners, right? And the highliners being kind of like the fishermen that make the most money and catch the most fish. I think he was really trying to communicate, okay, if you're in the fishing industry now, you shouldn't see this sort of effort and advocacy on our part as a threat to you. And I think that's sort of groundwork that they're starting to lay and probably is going to take a lot more work to, like, convince other industry stakeholders that I heard from in my story, who I think were pretty, like, leery, if not outright, like, hostile to the idea of messing with limited entry whatsoever. But I think that's sort of a challenge that the advocates who are working on this are aware of and kind of ready to work on.
And, you know, speaking of lawmakers and maybe a lack of will to even bring this up at the Capitol, you spoke broadly to legislators about this. It sounded like there wasn't a ton of interest. They were dealing with the budget and school funding. But in particular, you spoke with Senate President Gary Stevens, who is from Kodiak, who, you know, represents some of the folks that are concerned about this. And what did he tell you?
I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. He was fairly extraordinarily dismissive. You know, I think he was distracted. You know, there's a lot going on in Juneau right now. But, you know, his he declined to participate in a panel. I sent out a survey to a bunch of, you know, all the coastal legislators that nobody filled out. And he did not agree to be interviewed. And when I sort of approached him in the hallway, his response was basically like, yeah, we're going to work on this. We'll put some time and energy into it, but I don't see any need to speak with you about this at all. And I think my reaction was like, I can write my story. I don't need his point of view. I think I was surprised that given the sort of urgency and severity that many of his rural village indigenous constituencies like are treating this issue, that he was not willing to engage with me on it. But that's totally within his rights not to participate.
That was Northern Journal reporter Nat Herz. Find his full story at northernjournal.com.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member.
The massive budget reconciliation bill the House delivered to the Senate would block Medicaid patients from receiving care at Planned Parenthood health centers. And healthcare providers and advocates in Alaska are afraid that would prevent many Alaskans from getting critical health care. Rose O'Hara Jolly is Planned Parenthood's Alaska director and facilitated a roundtable Tuesday with providers and advocates in the state. They say many Alaskans on Medicaid who go to Planned Parenthood clinics now may have no other option.
The loss of Planned Parenthood would further exacerbate the need for people to travel across Alaska to receive care. Residents in rural Alaska who already face barriers to care will be the most affected.
The state has two Planned Parenthood clinics, one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks, which provide preventative sexual health care, cancer screenings, contraception, and abortions. Abortions made up about 4% of all services at the clinics across the country last year, according to their annual report. The Juneau Planned Parenthood closed late last year, and O'Hara Jolly says providers in the area report they have not been able to fully absorb the health needs of former patients. Josie Hayano is a social worker and advocate for those harmed by human trafficking. She says Planned Parenthood clinics have earned the trust of some of Alaska's most vulnerable people.
I have seen firsthand how often survivors of intimate partner violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking access Planned Parenthood and access that through Medicaid eligibility.
Advocates at the roundtable urged Alaska's congressional representatives to vote against the Big Beautiful Bill. The U.S. House passed their version of the bill last month, and the Senate is likely to release their draft in the coming days. Well, a few youth summer camps in Denali National Park were canceled after some probationary park's employees were fired by the Trump administration earlier this year. Some staff have since been rehired, and a few of the camps are getting back on track. But as Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, the people who run them say this summer is not going to be the same.
Jody Rodwell directs the Denali Education Center, a nonprofit that partners with the National Park to run outdoor youth programs like the Denali Discovery Camp. Denali Discovery has brought mostly Alaskan youth onto public lands for more than two decades, but the camp was canceled this year for the first time since the pandemic. Rodwell says the chaos resulting from the mass firings of federal employees influenced that decision.
It was at Valentine's Day that the Denali National Park Education Program Manager was let go. That's a pivotal time when we're doing our planning and our hiring.
Unlike the s'mores often enjoyed by campers, Rodwell says the program isn't completely toast. The National Parks Education Manager was rehired in May, which gives her hope that they'll be able to bring the camp back next year. And their program for high schoolers, Denali Backcountry Adventures, is now back on the calendar for July. Meanwhile, a similar nonprofit, Alaska Geographic, is working with the park to help fill the void. The group is planning a day camp oriented towards local kids.
Andy Hall directs Alaska Geographic. He says his organization isn't as worried about federal workforce cuts as they are about losing certain federal grants. But in the meantime, Hall says he hopes these programs to get kids outside will continue to build support for the parks, so they'll be around for generations to come.
Our mission is to connect people with public lands. And so when we bring young people out and we have an experience, they learn that these are lands that are owned by all of us.
Representatives from Denali National Park did not respond to requests for comment. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
A few decades ago, if you wanted to get a tattoo in Anchorage, you likely visited a male-owned shop. But that's changing. Now, female tattoo artists are easy to find in the state's largest city. And as Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, customers say female tattooers tend to create welcoming environments that make them feel at home.
Laura Craver is adding blue, green, and yellow ink to a tattoo that holds a lot of meaning for Alex Johnson. There are several sections, each representing memories from his 20-year relationship with his husband.
This is Yosemite in California. We were park rangers there. This is Wisconsin, where we first met.
This isn't Johnson's first tattoo, but he says it is the first that has felt like an inviting experience. The piece that covers his entire upper arm has been a years-long work in progress. He's built a friendship with Craver and says their connection keeps him coming back.
It's a very vulnerable act to get a tattoo, and so to do it with someone who makes you feel comfortable, makes you feel safe, and makes you feel beautiful. Like, that's a really incredible gift.
Tattoo artists are licensed by the Alaska Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. The board doesn't keep statistics on gender, but anecdotally, tattoo artists in Anchorage say the number of female-owned and operated studios in the city is on the rise. Craver has been working in the industry for over a decade and opened Brightside in 2022. She says she decided to start her own shop because she wanted a space that felt different than the average studio, one that felt safe for all identities.
All we want to do is just make people happy, and everybody who comes in the door is excited to be here.
The baby pink walls are covered in sheets of tattoo designs, traditional Alaska Native artwork, and framed pinned insects. Four artists share the space in the South Anchorage studio, and Craver says they're known for bringing their identity to their tattooing. Brightside prioritizes hiring women, BIPOC, and queer artists, Craver says, because they can face additional hurdles in the male-dominated industry. She says the studio attracts clients that want to see themselves represented in their artist and the art they create.
I think that there are a lot of our clients who very specifically only feel comfortable being tattooed by a woman or by a queer person or by a person of color, and so they specifically gravitate towards this space because they know that that is what they're going to have access to.
An overwhelming majority of parlors in Anchorage were owned by men when Craver started tattooing 15 years ago, but things have changed. Deborah Yarian agrees. She grew up an aspiring artist in New York City drawing with dry mediums, charcoal, pencils, and pastels. She has owned Eagle River Tattoo since 2008. She says women tattooing, and wearing the art itself, was seen as immoral when she started almost half a century ago. But that stigma has faded, and she says that means more people want tattoos.
Society's perception has changed, but it has almost gone the totally different way. I mean, now everybody is tattooed.
The number of Americans with tattoos has more than doubled over the last 25 years, according to data from National Geographic and the Pew Research Center. And it's not just machine tattoos seeing a shift. According to Holly Nordlum, an Inuit tattoo artist originally from Kotzebue, there is a growing number of female traditional tattooers in Alaska. Instead of a buzzing machine, Inuit tattooing uses hand stitching and hand poking techniques. Nordlum started traditional tattooing about a decade ago when she says she struggled to find a female artist.
I really couldn't find anything that suited what was most traditional, which is like women for women. Really wasn't happening in Alaska at the time.
Now, she says there are 8 Inuit tattooers, mostly women, spread across the state in Anchorage, Cordova, and Uktiagvik. At Eagle River Tattoo, Yarian says she's worked to create a safe space for women tattooers and clients. And she says that mindset has taken over the industry in Anchorage.
We're fortunate that a lot of the studios here are pretty inclusive and safe places for all people.
She encourages tattoo artists to build a relationship with their clients to make sure they feel comfortable and safe. In Anchorage, I'm Ava White.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Wesley Early, Leona Niden, Hannah Floor, Rachel Cassandra, and Ava White in Anchorage, and Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
I've tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Before my time made your heart sad and blue, and so my heart is paying now for things I didn't do. In anger, unkind words I said that make the teardrops start. Why can't I free your doubtful and melt your cold, cold
I've always been the one to say the first goodbye. Had to love and lose 100 million times. Had to get it wrong to know just what I like. Now I'm falling. You say my name like I have never heard before. I'm indecisive, but this time I know for sure. I hope I'm not the only one that feels it all. Are you falling? Center of attention, you know.
Make you pain like I do. Still can't shake it. Whoa. explosion, headlights can go over. Oh, Einstein is right.
Straight's baby blue. And when she moved back to San Jose, it was missing you in purple rain that I leaned on to get me through. It's been the soundtrack to my life since I remember. My memories were all in stereo. American radio keeps me singing along, living my life to the words of the songs of lovers and dreamers and hopeless believers like me. No matter where I go, I can always find an old friend somewhere there on the dial to sing me right back home on American radio. Hear two notes, so give me three steps and I'm back on a boat with my granddad in 1989. And all I need to hear are the first few words of Jumpin' Jack Flash or even Freebird, and I'm ready for a good time. American radio keeps me singing along, living my life to the words of the songs of lovers and dreamers and hopeless believers like me. No matter where I go, I can always find an old friend somewhere there on the dial to sing me right back home on American radio. Barry White in that backseat, the ups and downs, my highs and lows, I lived them all in stereo. American radio, well I'm still singing along, making up half of the words to the songs of lovers and dreamers and hopeless believers like me. No matter where I go, I can always find an old friend somewhere there on the dial. Thank you.
for some time. Can't stop staring at those ocean eyes. Burning cities and napalm skies. 15 flares inside those ocean eyes. Your ocean.
chances. Chances are lost, our hopes torn out pages.
The Yunga Tribal Council is a proud sponsor of KSDP and Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting. Thank you for your support.